Okay, so this week we're talking about Look Who's Talking.
Such a recent film.
Yeah, this is. I think this may actually be the oldest film that we've done so far.
Yeah, it must be.
Yeah, I think so. This is 1989. It's a really weird film, which spawned an even weirder series of films.
I don't think it's that weird, you know. When you suggested it, I was surprised.
You'd not seen it before, right? This is the first.
I hadn't seen it.
Yeah. Had you heard of it?
Yeah, loosely.
Okay.
I think in my head, Bruce Willis as a talking baby had become Boss Baby.
Right. Okay. Have you seen Boss Baby?
I have not seen Boss Baby.
I was actually really disappointed with Boss Baby when I saw Boss Baby.
I'm baffled that you can be disappointed as in you had expectations that were higher than what it is. But that's what I was imagining, even though obviously totally different. I mean, it's animated for a start.
And Boss Baby is, yeah, yeah. This is live action.
Yeah, just totally different era, right?
Yeah.
I think I was pleasantly surprised by this because, yeah, I just thought it was fun.
Sure. And I think when I say it's a mad film, the series gets progressively mad as it goes on. Mm. But the thing that's most mad to me is just how successful this film was.
Yeah.
Because if it was some sleeper film that made double its budget, sort of did okay, and it was sort of a cult classic kind of thing, I could maybe get on board a little bit more. It's just it made $300 million on a budget of about $10 million. It was so unbelievably successful. And there's something just baffling about that to me.
Bruce Willis is the voice of the thoughts of a baby, but it's also John Travolta, Kirstie Alley, directed and written by Amy Heckerling, who did Clueless.
First Times at Ridgemont High, right?
Yeah, exactly. So within that era, I mean, $300 million is insane. That is a lot of money, especially back then. But it doesn't surprise me that much because it was, first of all, it's end of the 80s, start of the 90s, which is a weird time anyway for film and TV in terms of what was popular, what was being made.
I actually like that era a lot.
And this fits so perfectly into that.
Sure.
And also, I feel like maybe we're looking at it in a context that's slightly clouded with now, in that now, you know, we have paralysis of choice, right? There's too much to see all the time.
Yeah.
And so when something does do really well, you can kind of find a reason for it, with exceptions, obviously. But with this, what else was out at that time?
Terminator?
Terminator is also completely batshit.
Oh, actually, no. Terminator 1 is 84, so Terminator 1 is a little bit earlier. Films from this era are batshit. Films from the 80s, films from the most of the 90s as well are pretty batshit.
Yeah.
Look Who's Talking is relatively benign on that spectrum in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Watching Look Who's Talking back, I liked it more than I did the first time because it does take a weird swing.
Yeah.
And everything back then was all about taking weird cocaine-fueled swings at things. Right, you look at Back to the Future, you look into the 90s, like Mrs. Doubtfire, you look at, like stuff like Terminator.
Great concepts.
Great, bizarre, nutty concepts. Mm. The central conceit of the baby talking, so we're hearing the baby's thoughts.
Mm.
It doesn't really play into anything that happens in the film very much. Kind of a little bit towards the end.
That's exactly why I liked it so much.
It's just so odd.
It doesn't matter. And it's Bruce Willis and it's hilarious because they're matching his dialogue, which is the thoughts of the baby.
Mm.
They're more or less matching to what the baby is doing. So it feels improvised.
Yeah.
And it felt like this big joke of the production.
Yeah.
And it's kind of an in-joke with the audience of we can hear the thoughts, but the adults can't hear the thoughts. And then you have all these amazing scenes where the other babies see each other and they're basically adults talking. And I was so here for it. I think because I had gone in with really low expectations and then that opening sequence of the conception through the tunnels.
Yeah, and they use that at the end as well, right? For the end credits.
Yeah, and then they have it at the beginning of the sequel.
Yes, well, because the end is feeding into the second, because they're conceiving the second baby at the end of the first film, right? I think.
No, it's just the beginning of the second one.
Is it? I'm pretty sure the end credits of the first film have...
They're just having sex, but then...
Another conception. They're just
having sex, because then at the beginning of the second one... Yeah, because he's older. It's like, he's like three by that point.
Yeah, and it's Roseanne Barr is the sister, right?
Yeah. I thought the comedy was so good. It's not trying too hard. It's not really trying hard at all. And also, it's a tight 90 minutes. It's like 96 minutes, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And again, with what we've got now, even a comedy film is unlikely to be that short. And it was so nice to just have these fast cuts, not even fast sequences, but we cut away at the end of a scene and a joke, and then we're on to the next thing, and we might be on to the next thing days later. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it was well paced in that sense, for sure.
Really well paced.
You do have a few time jumps in it as well, right? Because he goes from newborn, and then you've got him as a toddler, and then you've got, I think the majority of the film is him when he's closing in on one, that kind of age. Because I think John Travolta mentions at one point, so John Travolta, wait, just to briefly go over the plot with you.
Don't pull it apart. It's so good.
Well, no, but it's John Travolta is the taxi driver. So, okay. So Christy Alley gets pregnant by a married man played by George Segal.
Her boss. Not her boss, her client.
Yeah, he's a client. So she's an accountant.
She's an accountant, which I love, by the way, because it's the best way to make sure that she always has money through the whole sequels. She's got money.
Yeah.
And I really liked that framing as it in 1989 for the single mother to not be worried about money at all is a really interesting take.
Well, and you know that this is loosely based on Amy Heckling's...
on her life.
Yeah. So her daughter, she conceived by Harold Ramis.
Yeah.
He was married at the time and then ended up with a third woman rather than ending up with her.
Yeah, which is what happens in...
Which is, yeah, exactly what happens in the film, right? And I will say that that is a very, very funny line when George Segal says, I'm going through a selfish period right now. That was good. That got me. George Segal as well. I've actually seen a couple of things with him in recently. He plays a sleazeball so well. We watched To Die For the other day, which George Segal is also in, which is a Gus Van Sant film from the mid-90s. George Segal's in that as well. He only pops up briefly in that, but he pops up as this sleazy speaker at a conference who's explaining how you get into television to Nicole Kidman.
Mm.
He's explaining it while he's got his hand on her leg.
Okay.
And it's pretty unpleasant. I don't want to go through it blow by blow, but yeah, he's explaining how you get into television in that film. And I've seen a couple of things recently where he plays a sleazeball.
One of the reasons that I think I went into this film, it is surprising now that I think about it, how much I enjoyed it. But the fact that the opening with all these sperm with different voices, which I think John Travolta is definitely the voices of the... No, Bruce Willis and John Travolta voice the sperm in the second one. I'm not sure if they do in the first one. They must do. So at the beginning of the sequel, John Travolta is the sperm and Kirstie Alley is the egg.
Oh, really?
As the voices.
Oh, that's interesting. When I just looked briefly back at some of the reviews of the second one, because the second one was comparatively panned.
I mean, it sounds bizarre to say it, but I was disappointed with the second one. I went in with low expectations for the first one and I really did love it.
Yeah.
The fact that you start with this really bizarre, almost puppet conception sequence.
Mm.
Is it the first thing you see is Kirstie Alley trying to do her accounts and George Segal is just like trying to kiss her the whole time and she's like, no, we have to. He's all over her,
all
and
over,
it's disgusting.
Yeah.
I think that again just brought the bar even lower, that everything after that I was totally here for.
Right. Okay. So your expectations have been set so low by that point.
I had a great time.
Yeah. Because you do start to pick apart the rest of the film and it does start to look a little bit odd. John Travolta picks her up after she's just broken up with her baby daddy, George Segal. So he picks her up in his taxi. He's the first person that she meets after that point. And
she goes into labor.
Drives her recklessly. Yeah. So she's going into labor when she's just been broke up with. And he drives recklessly through the streets of New York to get her to the hospital.
Which I loved. I thought that was great.
He goes into the hospital with her and he's just kind of there for the rest of the film.
But then that's what's so funny about it is he's just there.
Yeah.
He's about to leave and the guy is like, here, put these on. You need, because everyone assumes he's the dad.
Yeah.
I guess the biggest stretch is why she trusts him to be a babysitter.
Yeah, that was an odd moment, right? Especially after, so she trusts him to be a babysitter after everything she's learned about him at this point is that he's kind of a small-time con man. He also takes her baby.
Yeah, that's after? No, that is...
I think that's before she's trusted it. So she says to him, like, maybe you can babysit sometime.
It's while that, because she falls asleep, right?
Yes, she falls asleep. So she says, maybe you can babysit sometime. She falls asleep immediately after that. This is the same scene. So she's barely
she
met
says,
this
can you
guy.
Watch? She says, can you watch him?
Yeah, okay, sure. And then he takes the baby out for the day. Yeah, and he takes the baby out to meet his grandfather. He takes the baby all around town.
Yeah.
And then she trusts him to be her babysitter going forwards after that.
When you said, when you start to pick apart the rest of the film, I don't think this is the kind of film that needs to be picked apart.
You're right.
Do you know what I mean?
You're
That's
right.
why I enjoyed it so much, because I also love this era of film. There's something so familiar and nostalgic about the costume, the set design, the music, the cobbled togetherness of it, that it feels like they just went, yeah, fuck it, let's do that, and made a film.
When you start to pick it apart as well, you do realize that there is a kind of breezy tone to it.
Yeah.
That you don't always see in film, or we very rarely actually see in films these days, because there's this strain of realism that came in and affected everything. I guess probably after 9/11, right? things got heavy after that point, right? Whereas back then it was just Talking Babies and Mrs. Doubtfires.
Yeah, and like Lethal Weapon and...
Yeah. You know that you're watching a film, right? You really know that you're watching a film, and that's fine. Yeah. There's no serious deep social commentary going on in this type of film, in this type of breezy tonal film. Mm. It's just a bit of fun.
It is fun. And then I feel like because it's Amy Heckerling and, you know, I love Clueless, it's also this questionable strain of feminism that I find so interesting.
Okay.
The whole point of the sequel is that she won't let John Travolta do anything, basically. Like, he is now, they're now married, they have the kids together, and she controls everything.
Right, okay.
There's that film between them, and then there's the kids, what they're living and what they're experiencing of, you know, Bruce Willis having a baby sister and what she's going through and that kind of thing, which have absolutely nothing to do with each other whatsoever.
But that's exactly my point. And maybe I'm sort of misremembering the second one, mashing them together a little bit in my head, in that there are these two films that go on at the same time.
Mm.
Less so in the first one, I guess, but it is baby talking in his head, which kind of has nothing to do with the relationship drama, the love triangle situation that's going on with Kirstie Alley, George Segal and John Travolta.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't even see it as a love triangle. I guess it is, because then you have the bit where he comes over and John Travolta's really angry. And
yeah, they have a bust up, right?
Even the bit with when she's dating and he tells the date that she loves being treated badly and that kind of thing.
That is a very funny sequence. How that guy plays it, where every time there is a moment to pay, he just sort of wanders off.
When they're at dinner, he's talking and they put the bill down and he just points at her.
And he's like, talking. He's talking about his medical ailment.
Yeah, he's talking about getting an enema.
Surprisingly painful.
There were so many good moments like that.
I feel that the baby's comedy interjections at certain points undercut that there is a heavy plot going on between the adults.
Mm. Is it heavy?
I mean, it kind of is. The baby is witness to several instances of physical violence.
This goes back to the era. One of the things that I found so funny about this film is that it's mostly the real baby. They're not using toys. They're not using props. It's
not
baby.
A CGI baby.
It's not a CGI baby. And you would not get away with filming the shit that they do with this child around now.
If they had thrown this baby like an American football at one point in the film, I wouldn't have been surprised.
He basically does that. He's like shaking the baby when he's dancing with him.
Yeah. Oh, on that point as well, there is a weird, and I don't mean this in like a dodgy way at all, but there is a weird structural element that the film kind of plays like a romantic comedy between John Travolta and the baby.
I don't know. I mean, I see what you mean, but I think...
He has more rapport with the baby than he does with Kirstie Alley, because she's constantly... That's how he ultimately wins her over, right? She comes home to him babysitting and he's fallen asleep with the baby on his chest, right?
Yeah, but she
hears
him.
He just looks
him,
like the dad.
She hears him say, yeah, he's acting, well, is he acting like a father? I mean, he's kind of acting like a child. Yeah, but to go back to your point of the...
the baby undercutting.
Yeah, I think, again, that's a reason why I've really enjoyed this film. Because, like you say, there's this thread of romance going through.
Mm.
And that can get really annoying. And I loved the fact that any time that was getting a little heavy... There was just a really base level joke coming from the baby or coming from something else that just kept pulling it back. It was only at the end of the film that I was like, oh, this is a rom-com. Mm. I really appreciated that balance of it being much more of a comedy film than a romance. And I think it would have suffered for being heavier because I don't think that would have pulled it off.
Okay, so talk to me about how they managed that balance in the sequel.
Oh, it was terrible.
Yeah. So, okay. So that's maybe more of what I was remembering when I was looking back at this film, is that it moves into full scatological pee pee poo poo.
It doesn't work at all.
Silly baby stuff going on while you've kind of got a heavy adult plot going on.
Both directions. You have the parent stuff is way heavier. Mm. Like her brother comes to stay and he's an asshole and he's got a gun. And then,
what?
Yeah. And like Travolta doesn't want him to be there, but Kirstie Alley is just like, he's my brother. Why would I not? You know, she's picking him over John Travolta. And then you've got the kids dealing with the daughter being born and the son potty training. But then you also have these really wild, again, maybe this is why I was thinking of puppet stuff, because the toilet becomes this creature and the kid is scared of his toys at night and they're all, is all puppets and kind of electric lights and stuff, which I thought was really interesting. Mm. Very Muppets.
Yeah.
For me, the first one, the two different storylines are at least quite a similar tone. So undercutting doesn't matter so much because we're just jumping between the two things that are fairly close. Whereas for the sequel, and I had planned to watch the third one and then I watched the second one. I was like, oh, okay, never mind. And then in the sequel, both of those threads have been pulled so much further apart that the undercutting is kind of nauseating as you flip between these two different stories.
Right, okay. And maybe the first time I had just watched the first two back to back, because I definitely don't think I've seen the third one, which is Look Who's Talking Now.
Yeah.
Where they completely ditch the baby talking element of the film.
Oh, wow.
Bruce Willis and Roseanne Barr don't return for that one. Instead, you've got Danny DeVito and Diane Keaton as the voice of their family dogs.
Wow.
Yeah, so they just take a completely different direction.
I mean, it's funny because also I'm thinking now back to the second one, there are some really amazing visual gags. And I think a lot of this is down to Kirstie Alley. Her reactions to things in the first one I found so funny. Like, she's so good at playing genuine outrage. So you really feel that she's in it. And then in the second one, a scene where it starts on a shot of, because her whole family are accountants, right?
Yes, yeah. And her dad only does accountancy. He doesn't speak.
Doesn't speak, ever.
He just does accountancy with his little... What's that type of hat that they used to wear?
Like a visor.
That kind of visor? Yeah.
Yeah. Sun visor.
He's just doing pre-computer accountancy with a visor on.
Constantly.
And that's all he does. Yeah.
So there's this fridge magnet that says accountants can do it without losing their balance. And then as the door shuts, it's her mum. It's so funny. It's not her fridge. It's her mum's fridge. I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, I think I've been a little bit unfair on this one, on looking back at it. And I think it is one of those things where it's a little bit sullied in my mind by what came after.
That's fair enough. There are still some bits where, you know, it's questionable. There is some very inappropriate dancing. And then after they've done that for 5 minutes, they say, we shouldn't do this in front of Mikey. It's
like, oh, yeah, shit, yeah.
As a line from John Travolta, when he first meets Mikey, when he's doing the babysitting, and he says, you spend 9 months trying to get out and the rest of your life trying to get back in.
Also, the baby, Bruce Willis as the baby, does full on say the R word as well, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. He says, I look like an R word when his mother is dressing him at one point as well. It's a film from 1989, right? And it's resolutely from 1989. It's not as bad as some stuff from that time, but...
Even in the second one, which is 1993, Damon Wayans is his best friend, Eddie.
1990.
Oh, it's 1990.
The third one's
93. Next day.
Next day.
Just knocked it out of the park.
Yeah.
When I saw...
Oh, Damon Wayans, yeah.
Yeah, when he's... So he plays Eddie, Mikey's best friend at the sandbox, basically.
Okay.
I was thinking about it afterwards, because he's a really fun character. Mm. I was like, oh, no, he's just playing the magical Negro character. Like, he just teaches Mikey everything, and that's it.
He's a baby magical Negro character, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mikey's whole arc is potty training, and Eddie is basically like, if you want to get the girls... You got to learn how to go potty.
Isn't the kid by that point, he's had a younger sibling at that point. He's like 3 or 4 years old, right?
Yeah.
Should he not be both speaking and potty trained by that age?
Well, he is speaking, but they're dubbing over it.
Oh, they're just overdubbing everything that he says.
Yeah, because it's like baby talk. I think he's like three.
Right, okay, because they are kind of doing that in the first film a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
But not fully. It looks as well like the third film is a completely different writer-director as well. So
that was why I was like, I'm not going to, I'll take that excuse to not watch it. Yeah. But without looking at any of the things that you're looking at.
Yeah.
There was a, because I know you have it all up, so don't look. One interesting thing about the sequel, I don't know if you remember who played the adult that runs the baby gym. Do you remember who it was? Because it's someone that we spoke about recently about voice acting.
Manager of the baby gym. Someone that we spoke about in regards to voice acting.
Yeah, so not on the podcast, but we were talking recently about voice acting. Oh. And there was a name that came up that we were talking about for quite a long time. And then he is in this as the baby gym instructor.
Shit, no, hit me. Who is it?
Gilbert Gottfried.
Really?
Yeah.
You see, that casting, like, okay, so the first film, you got George Segal, who kind of plays a bit wacky.
Mm.
Like, he's on the edge of wacky.
Yeah.
Kirstie Alley and John Travolta as well, they have the chops and they have the ability to go to the edge of wacky without going overboard.
Yeah.
Casting Roseanne Barr and Gilbert Gottfried and Damon Wayans, those are people that up the stakes in terms of the wacky factor, right?
Yeah, yeah. Just hearing Iago come in was really strange. The sequel was nominated for 2 Razzie Awards, and those were for Gilbert Gottfried and Roseanne Barr.
Looking at the sequel a second ago, it looks like... Oh, no, it's not the sequel. It's the third film. The third film is on Wikipedia's list of films with a 0% rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
Mm. To go back to what you were saying about being on the edge of the scale,
it
does lead to a kind of finale sequence of John Travolta, Elvis dancing with all the kids at the baby gym.
The second film.
The second film, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I've got to say, if anyone can do that, and pull it off, it's John Travolta.
Oh, absolutely. And he's such a bizarre actor with such a bizarre career. You look back at his career and you just kind of never know what he's going to do next, right?
I see, he's a really interesting guy. And I think you can kind of tell how much fun he's having on this as well, especially in the first one. Mm. A lot of the times he's making a joke and he's already laughing at it.
He's someone that you can read joy on his face.
Yeah.
And you can see when he's not enjoying a filmmaking experience, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Have you seen Battlefield Earth?
No.
It's that, I'm pretty sure I'm thinking of the right one. It's
Oh my God, sorry. Go ahead, I'll tell you after.
So Battlefield Earth is the Scientology science fiction film. And I think he was really keen to be in it, being a Scientologist. And he's one of the lead actors in it, if not the lead actor in it. And from my vague memories of Battlefield Earth and John Travolta's performance in that, it's an absolute box office bomb. It sucks as a film, but it does look like he's having a good time.
It is an interesting film, the first one, Look Who's Talking, because... It was a box office hit. Like you said, it wasn't a sleeper film. It wasn't a cult success. It was day one.
Massive
success.
Hit. Yeah.
And it was Travolta's most successful film since Grease.
Yep.
Which is crazy.
It's crazy when you think it's, I guess it was Grease, this, and then Pulp Fiction.
What about Saturday Night Fever?
Saturday Night Fever's 77, Grease is 78.
Mm.
So they're definitely in the same moment and the same kind of role that he was playing, right? And then Look Who's Talking is 10 years later, and he's playing pretty different kind of character.
Mm-hmm.
And then Pulp Fiction again, pretty different kind
Very
of character.
Different,
and then he moves into all sorts of stuff. His
Hairspray.
Career is so strange. Exactly. Yeah, Hairspray. But then like Face Off as well.
Oh my God, Face Off. I forgot about Face Off.
I love Face Off, by the way.
Face Off is brilliant. I think you showed me Face Off.
Face Off and Con Air are two films which have no right to be good.
The best Nick Cage.
I watched Con Air again recently. I mean, Con Air is phenomenal film.
I love Con Air. I think I prefer Con Air to Face Off.
It fits exactly into what we're talking about with Look Who's Talking in that
makes no sense.
That it makes no sense. It's a movie.
Isn't it? He's like...
Dumb old movie.
He's in prison because he killed someone with his hands, but it's classed as a...
His hands are a deadly weapon.
Right.
Which is true of everyone, right? Right.
That's it. He gets a harsher sentence because he's trained in
Yeah, because he was in the military, and so he's got a harsh sentence because he should know better than to. But he's like, it's self-defense as well, right? It doesn't make any sense.
But then you have these moments where the Steve Buscemi bit where he's talking to that girl.
Yes, the little girl with the tea party when they're at the swimming pool, dried up swimming pool in the middle of the, not in the middle, it's like next to the airstrip that they're simultaneously having a massive war with the police who are trying to catch all these criminals that have taken the one plane. So they're going to go fuel it up at this airstrip. So much fun. So much fun.
So much fun. Such a killer cast as well.
Oh, yeah, you've got Buscemi, you've got Malkovich, you've got... Is Ving Rhames in that one?
And it's also...
Dave Chappelle's in it. I mean, obviously Nicolas Cage and John Cusack as well.
John Cusack is who I was thinking, yeah. So I forgot that Steve Buscemi is in it.
I mean, he's the guy that you were talking about at the swimming pool having the tea party, right?
No, sorry. I forgot that John Malkovich is in it.
Oh, right, yeah. They're probably the two craziest people in the film,
right?
Yeah.
Because John Malkovich is... Is he gagged or is that Steve Buscemi?
Steve Buscemi. He has a Hannibal Lecter style mask on, like he has a muzzle because he's...
So bad.
Yeah, he's so scary. And then John Malkovich is Cyrus the Virus. I can't remember if it's because he does computer stuff or if it's because he does biological warfare stuff. But.
Wow, we might have to do an episode on this.
If we're talking about far from ideal, it's impossible to talk about anything being far from ideal with Conair because it is almost the perfect film. So let's talk about Nick Holt, shall we, and how he relates to the film Look Who's Talking. Ideally in 6 steps or less.
I just got a wires crossed thing where I was like, I mean, he's been in a film with Nick Cage.
Oh, shit. Yeah, that's immediate, right? So that's...
That's Conair.
Wait, what do you mean?
So I was linking it to Con Air, not to Look Who's Talking.
Oh, I'm with you. Oh, sorry, I thought you'd done the math already where it goes... Oh, no, but it doesn't go through Con Air, right? Yeah, it goes through
Face Off.
That's
what I mean.
Yeah, so it goes John Travolta, Face Off goes to Nick Cage. Nick Cage goes to Renfield. Renfield goes to Nick Holt.
Oh, well then, yeah, accidentally got that.
Smashed it. Yeah.
Whoops.
Easy peasy. Yeah. Do you want to try going through Kirstie Alley instead? That'd be a lot more difficult.
Okay, let's see. So Kirstie Alley...
I don't know much of her career.
She's in Sex and the City.
Is she?
In an iconic role where she dies by falling out the window.
Oh, wow.
It's amazing.
Wait, the TV show or the film?
The TV show.
The TV show, okay. She didn't have as extensive a film career as maybe I thought she had.
Yeah, a lot of TV.
Big in TV.
I'm going to try... Bruce Willis instead.
Yeah, that's probably going to be...
Well, it's just an extra step, isn't it? Because Pulp Fiction, John Travolta, Nick Cage.
Oh, yeah. You can't go through John Travolta again.
Fine.
That does exactly what you accused me of last time, which is...
No, I accused you of going to Brad Pitt twice.
Yes, exactly. And you're doing the same thing with... Yeah.
Not in the same loop, though.
Yeah. Oh, wait.
Not the same thing.
Kirstie Alley was in... Sorry, she was in Prince of Bel-Air. What the hell is this? 1986 American made-for-television romantic comedy film starring Mark Harmon, Kirstie Alley, and Robert Vaughn that has nothing to do with The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Wow. Was it before?
Yeah, 1986.
Okay. Bruce Willis. I'm going to go Looper.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I love that film. Paul Dano.
Oh, yeah. He was in Looper, was he?
Yeah, he's the colleague that young Joe kind of helps but doesn't. He's the one who we see all of his limbs disappearing when he's trying to find his older self. He's really good in that.
I need to rewatch that. I remember liking that
such
film.
Such a good film.
Yeah. Okay, I'm doing a parallel one at the same time.
Paul Dano.
Yeah, get ready for that.
No. Has Nick Holt done anything with Daniel Radcliffe? I feel like they should, but I don't think they have.
They really should, shouldn't they, if they haven't done it? You want to have...
Like a buddy movie.
Yeah, him, Daniel Radcliffe and Robert Pattinson, all together. That's what you need.
Oh, it's funny you said Robert Pattinson, because that's throwing me as well, because I went to Okja and Steven Yeun is in Okja.
Right, yeah.
I've got it.
I think I've got it. Wait, have I got it? I must have it.
Well, Lily Collins was born in Guildford. Does that count?
No! Don't bloody count. Wait, I think I've got it for Kirstie Alley.
Okay.
And it's an interesting route. So, okay, so Kirstie Alley was in a TV film called Prince of Bel-Air with, I had to go through that, with Robert Vaughn. Do you remember Robert Vaughn?
No, as in Vince Vaughn.
Nothing to do with Vince Vaughn at all, no. But he was a pretty big actor for a long time.
Oh, yeah. Bullet.
Yes, he was also, I believe that he was in, I think I'm getting this right, that he was in a British TV show about con artists. I think I'm thinking of the right guy at one point in time. I'm going to have to remember what that was called.
Was it Coronation Street?
It was not Coronation Street. Wait, actually, I'm going to have to just find that now, whatever the hell that was called. Oh, God. He was in so much TV from so many years. This is the stupidest thing. Hustle. He was in Hustle. Okay. Hustle. But he was also in an episode of Little Britain USA.
Don't tell me Nick Holt was in that.
With Matt Lucas.
Okay.
And Matt Lucas was in Paddington.
Nice.
With Hugh Bonneville, who was in Paddington 2.
Oh, I thought you were going to go Notting Hill to Hugh Grant.
Yeah, I mean, either way, I'm going to Hugh Grant. Right? He's been in a couple of things with Hugh Grant. Let's go Notting Hill, Hugh Grant,
About a Boy,
Nick Holt. There you go.
How many was that?
I've lost track. If you are listening to this or watching this on a platform where you can leave a comment, then tell me how many steps it was in. So the last thing I want to say about Look Who's Talking is that I think I may have misjudged it. I think the second film is burned in my mind as being compounded with the first film in such a way that I've been a bit unfair on the first film. And it actually does come from an era and tradition of films, which is quite fun, is quite, I think breezy is a word I used earlier, and I think that's probably a great word for the tone of what is good about this.
Mm-hmm.
And there were fun moments in it as well, rewatching it. I did enjoy lots of bits and pieces of it.
Mm-hmm. Great. I mean, I loved it. More Bruce Willis as a talking baby.
More Bruce Willis as a talking baby. I mean, I guess...
There are three, aren't there? Yeah, well,
there's two of these, yeah.
My thing was that rom-coms are always kind of stupid, and at least this one was funny.
That's fair enough. Even modern rom-coms, when we talked about like living outside of the realm of reality, with living outside of any kind of realism, that's where this sort of genre generally sits, right?
Yeah, have I spoken to you before about the frying pan test?
No, I don't. That doesn't sound familiar.
It's a writing technique to understand where on the scale of real or completely unreal your world is, where it sits on that scale.
Okay.
The way it works is you imagine yourself in the world that you're writing, and one of your characters takes a cast iron frying pan and hits another character around the head with it. What happens?
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
It's really good because even in something like if you take Die Hard as an example, depending who's getting hit, they're going to be reacting in a different way.
Yeah, of course.
You know, if it's comedy, there's going to be a clanging sound and they're going to just spin around
a bit.
See
stars,
Ken Loach, they're going to drop to the floor. In terms of frying pans, this was, I like where this sits.
Oh yeah, this is a full clanger, right? This is a...
Yeah.
Clangs off the head and then they slip on a banana skin and fall out of the window and then get hit by a piano that's falling out of a higher window at the same time, right?
I was thinking it's like a clang round the head and then the way it drops means that the eggs get flipped onto the baby's plate and then it
Yeah, exactly.